This is The Takeaway for August 28th, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. This hour, Walmart announces assault-style rifles will no longer be on their shelves. Plus, they may be just corn seeds, but to the U.S. government, they're a major national security issue. And we continue with a Takeaway book club today. Later this hour, you're going to hear three Takeaway listeners discussing Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book, Between the World and Me. But we begin the hour with an investigation into a small lobbying group that's having a huge influence. Last April, Michigan Democratic State Representative Stephanie Chang introduced a bill to regulate homeschooling.
We are not interfering with or questioning a parent's decision to homeschool. We are merely trying to protect those children who may be vulnerable and at risk of serious harm.
Now, Representative Chang planned to name the proposed law after two Detroit children who were found dead in their mother's freezer. Now, children hadn't been seen for years after their mother decided to homeschool them. And the mother is now accused of abuse and murder. Now, the idea here isn't that homeschooling caused the kid's death. But in cases like this, and in many other states, it's a concern that a largely unregulated homeschooling culture provides a haven for abusive or neglectful or simply unfit parents to poorly educate their kids at best or at worst, sequester them from society, and hide abuse. But Chang's office was inundated with calls and emails from angry parents protesting the bill, and that bill has not made it out of committee, and it isn't likely to, in part because of those angry parents affiliated with a lobbying group called the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, or HSLDA. A new investigation finds that Representative Chang in Michigan isn't alone. Plenty of state lawmakers have run up against HSLDA, and that's mainly what's kept homeschooling out of state regulations in many jurisdictions throughout the country. Joining me now is Jessica Hoosman. She's journalist and fellow with the Teacher Project at Columbia University. She's also author of an article from Slate and ProPublica, The Frightening Power of the Homeschooling Lobby. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, the first case I just mentioned, because it is horrific, we should restate, nobody is accusing homeschooling of being responsible for abuse and murder of children. It's more an idea of an institution that in some places shields children from their interactions with society at school.
Absolutely, yes. No one is saying, not even the abuse experts that I interviewed for this piece, that parents who homeschool are more likely to abuse their children. It's simply a regulatory structure that makes it easier to hide abuse. And especially in a state like Michigan, which is the state you were talking about earlier, homeschooled students are not even required to inform the state that they're being homeschooled. So you can literally fall off the face of the earth, which is what happened to these two children who weren't seen or heard from for years, and no one batted an eye about that because homeschooling is so unregulated in that state.
Now, homeschooling was illegal until about 25 years ago. What changed? What caused the change?
Around that time, people on the far left who wanted to unschool their children or pull them out of a structured school environment for more free-form learning, and conservative Christians on the very opposite end of that who wanted to pull their children out of school to give them a more homeschooled conservative Christian education, banded together and started going state by state to either move through bills in the legislature that regulated homeschooling or try laws that prevented homeschooling in courts. The HSLDA kind of caught on to the end of that and helped push over the last couple of states and became a force to be reckoned with in the mid to late 1990s.
Now, we both mentioned the HSLDA, I'll repeat, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Their leader, Michael Ferris, has been a real force in this. Who is he, and what strategies has he used to make what I think is a pretty small organization very powerful?
Sure. So he is a lawyer and also an ordained Southern Baptist minister who founded the HSLDA in the mid-1990s. And he rallied around a specific federal law in 1996 that would have required teachers to be certified in the subject that they taught. He assumed that this applied to homeschooling and sort of rallied troops by fear of federal regulation of homeschooling, even though even people in the homeschooling movement thought this was out of bounds. So he's used the same tactics he's been using since 1996 to tear down laws or roll back regulations across the country. So legislator after legislator that I've spoken to has said that what happens is that they get inundated with emails and phone calls, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of phone calls, to the point where their phone lines crash and they have to start using their private cell phones to conduct business. And so what really happens, as opposed to presenting good arguments in favor of not supporting the bill, they just bother the legislators to the point where they're so overwhelmed with calls that they just drop the bill because they can't get to anything else. So a legislator in Virginia, such as Tom Rust, who attempted to just study the religious exemption for homeschooling in Virginia, will get calls from as far away as California or Alaska because the HSLD has rallied troops nationally.
There's sort of a logic clash here when it comes to this fight, it seems to me, because the whole point of homeschooling, whether you're doing it from a liberal perspective or a conservative one, is removing your children from an education system that you might feel is overregulated, big government. You just want to educate them yourself.
Of course. And I think that there's definitely a legitimate reason why the HSLDA does the things that they do. I think it's simply surprising that a homeschool lobby, which is not something that most Americans even think about, wields so much power and controls so much regulation across the country. To be clear, the HSLDA's membership only represents about 15% of homeschoolers nationally. There are 1.5 million homeschoolers, and the HSLDA has about 85,000 memberships, and that represents about five family members apiece. So when you do the math there, that's about 15%. If you just take the three kids that Ferris says are represented by each membership, that's about 15% of the total homeschooling body. And so smaller secular organizations that do not have the same interests as the HSLDA are becoming quite concerned that an organization that has been aligned with conservative Christianity is speaking for a group that is incredibly diverse. But I think even minimum oversight has been eschewed by the HSLDA. And I've talked to plenty of families who say, I don't mind following this legislation. I don't mind following this specific rule in my state, because I know that even though I'm doing a good job, there are other kids who might be in danger or who might be getting a poor education who would be caught by this specific type of regulation. So I think it just depends on your viewpoint in terms of how much regulation you're willing to put up with so that other children can be protected.
And talk about the patchwork that results from this a little bit, because my understanding of this is in a place like New York State, you can homeschool, but you have to submit a lesson plan to the state, or at least let the state know that you're giving a proper education to your child, and then you can do that any way you want. Across the river in New Jersey, there's basically no regulation at all, and it's a situation where these children are off the grid.
Exactly. So in New York, you do have oversight in terms of submitting lesson plans to the state, taking periodic assessments, and meeting regularly with the people who are running education in your school district. If parents are upset with that level of regulation, all they would have to do is sort of hop across the Hudson River to New Jersey, where homeschooling is not mentioned a single time in their education regulations. So the people who homeschool in New Jersey do not have to tell the state that they're homeschooling. Their children never have to sit for any exams. There are no required subjects. It is totally unregulated.
So there's the academic regulation and the testing requirements, and I can understand why homeschooling parents wouldn't want to have anything to do with some standardized test or academic regulation from the state capitol. The abuse side of this that you've also discussed, which is a separate issue, the idea that homeschooled children in a state like New Jersey may never interact with teachers or school authorities or other students in a way that somebody raises an alarm if there's trouble at home. And that second part surprises me. How does the HSLDA respond to that part of it? The academic part I get. What about this other part?
Yeah, so they would say that despite having no data to support this, they would say that homeschoolers are abused at far less of a rate than people who are not homeschooled. And they would also say that students are regularly abused in public school settings, and that would offset the amount of abuse that we're talking about in homeschool. So they essentially say that parents know best what happens to their children and what should happen for their children. I will point out that neither side has credible data, right? So the advocates, like the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, point out the very obvious examples of abuse that come up time and time again. And the HSLDA point out the very obvious examples of success that come up time and time again. And there are plenty of examples on both sides. The problem is that because regulations are so varied state to state, there is no data at all nationwide to indicate how this population is doing nationally compared to their public school peers. So until we have that data, we're sort of working in this world of competing anecdotes, but we have no idea what's actually going on.
Jessica Huseman is a journalist and fellow with the Teacher Project at Columbia, and she's the author of a new Slate article, which you can read, a ProPublica investigation, The Frightening Power of the Homeschooling Lobby. Jessica, thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. We look now at a corporate decision that's found itself right in the middle of the national debate on gun control. It's a debate that resurfaced after Wednesday's shooting in Roanoke, Virginia, that left two journalists dead and another person injured. On the same day as the Roanoke shooting, Walmart, the country's largest seller of guns and ammunition, announced that it would no longer be selling modern sporting rifles. That's another way of saying assault-style rifles, including the AR-15. Now, some saw this as a response to that violence in Virginia, but a Walmart spokesman said the move was only a response to slumping demand for the guns. Now, Walmart also said that it's going to be adding to its offerings of shotguns and other weapons used by hunters and sportsmen. But at the same time, it doesn't disclose any sales figures to bring some light onto the decision. Americans have found some common ground on gun control. According to Pew Research, 85% of Americans favor expanded background checks for gun buyers. And background checks are up this summer. The FBI conducted 1.6 million checks in July for all gun sales. That's up from 1.4 million this time last year. But checks are actually considered to be an indicator of the market. So more checks suggests, at least according to analysts, more gun sales, not necessarily more enforcement. So the question now is whether Walmart's decision, even if financially motivated, will have any sway on the market for these assault-style rifles like the AR-15. Charles Fishman is author of The Walmart Effect, How the World's Most Powerful Company Really Works, and How It's Transforming the American Economy. And he says gun sales are up in America, so that Walmart's public reasoning doesn't quite add up.
Walmart is, going back 20 years, the largest seller of guns and ammunition in the United States. It's hard to believe that gun sales overall are rising, but Walmart is excluded from that. I think Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, 2 months ago made it clear he wasn't comfortable selling these kinds of guns.
Our focus as it relates to firearms should be hunters and people who shoot sporting clays and things like that. So the types of rifles we sell, the types of ammunition we sell should be curated for those things. And we believe in serving those customers. We have for a long time, and we believe we should continue to.
That's what he told CNN, actually, in the wake of the Charleston killing. So he had signaled very clearly that these guns were coming off the shelves. There just hadn't been an announcement. Interestingly, Walmart didn't actually release a piece of paper. There's no formal statement. And I think that's kind of revealing. They're trying to have an impact without there being tremendous Walmart blowback.
All right. Well, regardless of motivations, then, we've said it a couple times. Walmart is number one when it comes to firearm sales. So they're making this decision. What do we know about Walmart's influence in markets like this? And anyone who hopes that Americans are going to buy less guns, can they put any hope in the fact that Walmart is cutting back on assault-style rifles? Will it make any difference?
I don't think that this is Walmart's motivation. I think Doug McMillon made it clear he's uncomfortable selling this kind of weapon. I think if you take one step forward, you can imagine how horrified any seller of these guns, whether the scale of Walmart or a community gun store, would be if a weapon they sold was used in an event like Charleston or like what happened near Roanoke earlier this week. The impact Walmart is going to have is they widen the conversation. I think they may cause some people in the country to think, wow, if Walmart, which no one thinks is a bastion of liberal political theory or liberal political behavior, if Walmart can behave this way, maybe I'm not thinking about guns and gun sales in a completely constructive way. I don't think Walmart is trying to change the conversation, but I think the impact, just like Walmart saying, we believe gays have civil rights and should have civil rights and that that's good for America, which the CEO did just a few months ago in response to these religious freedom laws. I think what Walmart ends up doing is widening the conversation, is creating a space to talk about something where people may change their minds. And I think that's the kind of impact they're having.
Charles Fishman, aren't we also maybe seeing a symptom of Walmart's move from the outer suburbs and rural areas into the cities? I live in Washington, D.C. There are several new Walmarts there. And when Walmart wanted to come in, it faced the city councils of Washington, D.C. and all of their urban politics. And Walmart has been under pressure in lots of urban jurisdictions over gun sales. So maybe this is part of a reaction. Maybe they realize if they want to expand into the cities, they don't want to be seen as a purveyor of powerful guns.
Right. Walmart has very slowly cut back the number of stores it sells guns in. It used to sell guns in half or more of its stores. Now it's down to about a third. So that's been very quiet. You don't make an announcement about that. So I think there's something to what you say. I think you're seeing the impact literally of a CEO thinking a little differently about the kind of company he's going to run. I think Doug McMillon is trying to rehumanize this enormous corporation, the largest corporation ever created in human history. And I think by acting like a human being, by, you know, here Walmart did something this week that legislatures and city councils and Congress has failed to do. They just stepped up and said, you know, probably we don't need to supply these weapons. I'm not sure that lots of Walmart's customers agree with those positions in their own world. But I don't think Doug McMillon's worried about losing shoppers. I think what he's trying to do is put a real face back on a huge company. And also, I think he must feel like he's trying to do the right thing. Why wouldn't you take the Confederate flag merchandise out of the stores?
Well, it seems like whether it's gay rights or Confederate flags or high-powered assault-style rifles like the AR-15, Walmart is trying to change the conversation while avoiding all of the shouting. Charles Fishman, author of The Walmart Effect, How the World's Most Powerful Company Really Works. Charles, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
All right, so think for a second. What does your congressional district look like? And I don't mean the demographic profile or what kind of economy it has. I mean, what does it actually look like on a map, its shape? It almost certainly does not look like a square or a rectangle. And that's because congressional maps are drawn by state legislatures. And whatever party controls that legislature works very, very hard to make sure that those districts are drawn in a way that benefits their side, keeping voters you want in, dividing the voters you don't want out. And that's why so many districts look like snakes or hooks or spirals or sometimes nothing logical at all. But there's definitely a logic to it, political advantage. Now, Florida recently redrew some of its districts, much to the dismay of the state Supreme Court, which recently ruled that the new districts too heavily favored the Republican Party. And the Florida legislature called a special session, and it has not gone well.
Meanwhile, across the rotunda, they're tinkering with the maps. The nerve!
The nerve. That's Florida State Representative Matt Gaetz speaking in the State House on August 18th. Joining me now with more, Nick Evans, a reporter on Florida state politics at WFSU. Welcome to The Takeaway, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Representative Gaetz there is incensed, and so are a lot of other people. Florida isn't alone in having fights over redistricting, but what's going on?
Well, it's been going on for a little over a year now, actually. The most recent special session where they failed to draw a map is actually the second they've had in trying to redraw congressional borders. So right now, where we are is we are waiting for the Supreme Court to decide what to do next.
So this is basically an argument over gerrymandering, right? Good old-fashioned political advantage in drawing the congressional map.
Yeah, it kind of is. So the poster child for this debate has been District 5, which runs from Jacksonville to Orlando. And it does look like nothing that makes any logical sense. I guess one of the things that you should know about District 5 is that it started out as kind of a good idea. In 1993, federal judges decided that we should have a minority access seat there. What's happened in the past two reapportionments is that the Republican-controlled legislature has added more and more African-Americans to District 5. So it's gone from minority access to more minority packing within that district. And very recently, the courts have stepped in and said, you need to redraw the map. And so this time last year, they changed District 5 a little bit and District 10 a little bit. But then the state Supreme Court got involved and said, no, you need to change a lot more than that. The most recent special session, they were sent back to redraw eight districts, and they weren't able to come to an agreement.
And fitting all these Tetris pieces together isn't just about Democrats on Republicans or Republicans on Democrats. If you redraw two Republican districts next to each other, you can have two incumbents running against each other, and people don't like that.
What we're going to see likely is that a lot of lines move at least a little bit. I spoke with one political scientist earlier this week who suggests we could see as many as six new faces in Florida's 27-member congressional delegation. So it could have a pretty serious impact.
So who's the ultimate arbiter here? If Republicans that control the House and the Senate and the governor's office can't agree, is it ultimately up to the state Supreme Court? Is it up to the governor and the Speaker of the House? Who has the final say here?
That's a really good question. Nobody knows. Right now, the state Supreme Court is trying to decide if they want to step in and draw the maps. Now, in their July 9th ruling, they asserted the right to redraw borders, but said, we're just choosing not to invoke that right now. It's not necessarily clear that they can do that. If they step in and they draw the maps, expect a federal challenge immediately. But keep in mind, in this last congressional reapportionment alone, a total of nine states already have already had some level of court involvement in redrawing the maps.
Political advantage, minority access, and the weird puzzle piece game that is drawing congressional districts in Florida and across the country. Nick Evans with WFSU. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely.
This preview has been approved for all public radio audiences.
Nuclear secrets, official government cables, Hillary Clinton's emails. The idea of someone stealing these fill our blood with terror. But now, other nations are after something much more dangerous. Something that could bring down America as we know it. This time, our enemies go straight for the heartland.
Corn!
When China's spies go after our unguarded corn seeds, who will fight back?
I'm not making this up.
Only federal agents can protect our nation's most desired crop, but can they stop China from stealing our corn?
You're sure it's not just
a
bad dream?
It was a mission. And I was there.
The Corn Identity. Coming soon, or now.
You know, sometimes a real-life story can sound way too much like a cloak and dagger spy movie. But there have been a number of recent cases that have found Chinese agriculture executives guilty of trying to steal seeds from the test fields of U.S. agribusiness, giants like Monsanto and DuPont, including a guy named Mo Hailong. He was caught stealing from some Iowa cornfields in 2011, and the FBI says that he was involved in a scheme to steal U.S. biotech in order to produce American-quality corn crops in China. Ted Genoways is a contributing editor for The New Republic and an agriculture journalist, and he says that this is serious business because 94% of the corn that China imports is coming from the United States, and the Chinese are desperately trying to close that gap.
To start with, there's a situation where the middle class in China has been burgeoning, and one of the things that goes along with that is that there's an increased demand for luxury food items, most notably meat. Particularly in China, there's an interest in and an appetite for pork. And all of the pork that is being raised in China is being fed on corn. And so this means that there's a huge increase in the demand for feed corn. China doesn't have domestic production to come anywhere close to meeting that climbing need. So what they've been doing is importing American corn, and whenever they have a shortfall, they have to turn to the U.S. to cover that gap. So it really is a situation where they are totally dependent on us for this commodity.
And that's where theft comes into play, right? Now, explain what Mo Heilong was doing here.
Yeah, so the FBI's case is that they had reports that Mo had been found by farmers who were raising test seeds for Monsanto and for DuPont Pioneer in their fields. And in one circumstance, that was observed actually digging corn seeds out of the ground in order to just simply steal them right after they had been planted. And the reason for that is that those seeds contain really two vital pieces of information for a company like the one that Mo was heading up. And there's information that's contained there about the hybrid and the seed stock that is the seed itself. There's also the transgenes, the genes that have been inserted into genetically modified corn seed in order to make that corn express certain characteristics. And it appears that what Mo was doing was stealing seeds and then planting them at his own test plot that he had established secretly in Illinois in order to see what those seeds were capable of doing. And then the seeds that were producing the kind of crop that he wanted, he was attempting to smuggle out of the United States and back to China.
But this went to another level, Ted, because you're reporting that the government actually resorted to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, when they were tracking Mo. And I know a little bit about the FISA court. That's for terrorism and bombs going off and NSA surveillance, not for stealing corn.
That's right. So this is something new. It's a new development and a new usage of FISA. The language of FISA itself specifically says that this is an attack, sabotage, terrorism, or clandestine intelligence activities. So the bar is incredibly high. But clearly what happened here was that the FBI was making the case before the FISA court that there was enough value in these corn seeds to the American food supply and to our dominance of the world's food supply, that this was something that was a matter of national security.
Well, is it a matter of a company like Monsanto or DuPont with all of their power, you know, having enough clout to get the FBI to really go hard at their enemies? Or is that an example of the Obama administration sending a message to China? We're putting this up on the same pedestal as terrorism.
Well, I think it's a bit of each, and I think that it's very difficult, actually, historically, to separate the U.S. government's goals from the goals that they've established with some of these companies. I think it's important to remember that companies like DuPont and Monsanto started as defense contractors, and so it's not unusual to me that their corporate culture is to think of their products as matters of national security and as products that they are primarily aiming toward the U.S. government. And I think it's also not too surprising that the U.S. government sees those companies in the same light. What's changed is that rather than being part of the Department of Defense, they've moved over to the Department of Agriculture and are really trying to use American agriculture as a similar tool, and the USDA itself at various times has said even as a weapon in international relations. Going back to the Nixon administration, corn in particular has been used by the USDA as a food weapon against the Russians and against the Chinese.
I don't mean to sound too glib, but it's a mostly serious question. Are we getting to the point in the world where the Department of Agriculture is going to need a counterterrorism unit, or at least a counterespionage one?
Well, I think that they would argue that they would. And I think that the companies that are engaged in large-scale agriculture already have remarkable private security and intelligence gathering bodies. It's really striking any time that you are near an agricultural facility, the amount of security that is present. And I think it is not too unlikely that we will start to see that security moving away from research facilities and test sites and moving out to encompass all agricultural areas. The question, of course, that emerges is as the secrecy increases, What does that do to the public's right to know both about what's going on in the production of their food and also how these sorts of priorities are being set? When we talk about agricultural policy, are we talking about what's necessary to feed ourselves and to produce food that is healthy for Americans? Or are we talking about large-scale production that is really meant to control a world market and affect the way that international relations are carried out?
Ted Genoese is an agriculture journalist and contributing editor at The New Republic. Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Everyone, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday. This is Todd Zwillick on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.